So the people part, I'll just say it briefly, but obviously that was really important. And the U.S. was concerned, you know, with these people, with this knowledge, you know, tested, hands-on knowledge, and especially under economic hardship, would they go to Iraq, Iran, to North Korea? That's what they worried about. And so there were several programs were aimed at the people part. And of course, the stuff that we were doing, the science, you know, lab scientific activity, was a key component of that. And it's the one that the Russians themselves were most excited about for the reasons that I mentioned. The State Department started this program where, in essence, what they said, look, is we'll just take people who were in the nuclear weapons complex and we'll fund them based on their proposals to do non-nuclear weapons related work. They did a lot of that, and several of the people associated with that, Glenn Schweitzer particularly, who was working in the State Department at the time, did a splendid job in getting money and giving those scientists and engineers hope. And then the two programs mentioned here, the IPP, and the Nuclear Cities Initiative, were also aimed specifically at sort of transforming the work of many of these people inside of the nuclear weapons complex to doing commercial things. And so these were attempts to do that. Let me just say at the outset, the American government and various people who've looked at programs, they judge these as having been the least successful. Because the way Congress put the legislation together for these programs, the measures that you would look at as to whether you were successful is how many businesses did they start. You know, how much, it's like economic measure, like you would do out of business. Where it turns out, as you might imagine, doing business in the 1990s in the Soviet Union, that was hard. And then to have former weapons people do business and try to get in the commercial market was really hard. And so from that standpoint, you know, they had very little success, but they were hugely successful in helping the people deal with their dilemma as to what do they do, give them hope, to give them some hope. And bottom line, as you'll see, they didn't go sell their capabilities. So that's the sort of thing. This is one of these magnetic flux compression experiments. They love those. I happen to, since I told you yesterday, I really been trying to work to understand plutonium. But as you might imagine, the other place in the whole wide world that has been trying to understand plutonium are the Russians. And the woman shown here, Lidia Timofeeva, is the Russian nuclear metallurgist, plutonium metallurgist. I met her through my colleague Boris Litvinov, this is Yevgeny Kozlov, and we worked together from 1998 on. Took us 2 years to write this book, this article, A Tale of Two Diagrams, as to how two different aspects of plutonium were viewed from Russian and American side. And for 40 years, we thought the Russians didn't know what they were doing and their version of this was incorrect. Took me 2 years working with Lydia to figure out that they were right and we were wrong. And I still continue to work with her. I just had dinner with her a couple of months ago. So we've been trying to understand plutonium. That's the sort. Then we've had annual workshops on the science of plutonium, meaning the physics, the metallurgy, the chemistry. Those gave them hope. We did the industrial thing. We took in the nuclear bomb factories. We helped them with American money, government money, to gut some of those and try to put other civilian-related things in there. One of the most interesting aspects, I was talking about dialysis yesterday, and we worked with them on a dialysis program, and we got so close. We actually took a whole complex in their bomb factory in Avant-Garde, also in the city of Sarov. And we had a German company, Fresenius Medical, ready to invest tens of millions of dollars to have them build dialysis equipment. At the last minute, the Russian government decided they would not give them access that the Germans insisted they would have. They said, we have to have access in 24 hours. If something goes wrong in our assembly lines, we got to have somebody in there. And they said, can't do it. Can't give it 24 hours. So they pulled a plug. But lots of other things. We just had an enormous amount of activity. Bottom line is, I'll show you later, there were no brain drain problems. The loose nuclear exports, very interesting. In the 1990s, we had concerns about Iran and what they were doing with Iran. And Mikhailov did actually sign some secret deals with Iran. They were going to get them centrifuge equipment. They wound up not going through with that. They did help them complete the light water reactor, and I thought that was actually a smart move. But then after the 1990s, and also some of the institutes played at the margins of what's allowable, but for the most part, as we look at it now, you know, over the last 15, 18 years, they've become a responsible nuclear exporter. Because they figure out now the way to make money is actually legitimately. You know, they sell reactors, and it was said yesterday, the whole fuel cycle services. Today, the Russians are the only ones, like that reactor in Iran. They provide the fuel. They do the enrichment, the Russians. They provide the fuel. They have this reactor that they built. The Iranians are running it with Russian help. They get the spent fuel, and the Russians take it back. So there's no plutonium problem, there's no enrichment problem. So they're the only ones that do that. So in my opinion, they're quite responsible nuclear exporter. We also, we talked a lot about, so how do we, you know, we still have the responsibility, each of us. Los Alamos, Livermore, Sandia on our side, and their equivalent, three labs on their side. How do we take care of the nuclear weapons that are left in the stockpile? Because it turns out you can't just eliminate them all. So how do we do that? So Radi Alkayev, we worked on this together. He drew this cartoon, or his people drew that cartoon after a French artist who used the same figures. And he said, hey, look, we got a problem with stockpile stewardship, you know, taking care of nuclear weapons. That yesterday, you know, we had these men, you know, most of them were men, and we had everything. We had computers. We had the bombs, we tested the bombs, we had the warheads, tested them, and we had lasers. We had everything. Today, this was 1998. So, well, we try to teach the young man, and we tell him about those things. Yeah, we had computers, you know, we had the testing, we had the lasers. But tomorrow, you know, the young man's going to stand there, he's going to scratch his head. I don't know what to do with this stuff. You know, you can't test anymore, and only the portrait is in the wall. And so that's our concern as to what happens. How do we pass the tacit knowledge on to the people? So it's still the most important job of these laboratories. What do we learn? I'll just let you read this, but we learn a lot through this lab, and especially of how much we are alike. They're scientists and engineers. And we both had this grave sense of responsibility. There were lots of government programs besides lab to lab. Nuclear scientists and engineers played a role in some of these, but this was extensive. This sort of the list of non-LUGA program. And for us, the reason I have this one in gray is because the Clinton administration didn't do much in nuclear energy because of the Iran. They wanted the Russians not to do the reactor in Bushehr, and they were worried about what else they were doing with Iran. And then environmental issues. In essence, what the American government says, look, we're willing to do things so they don't proliferate, there isn't a problem, but we're not going to clean up the mess they made. We're not going to use American money to clean up the mess. I tried to come from a different angle to say, look, they've made a mess in several places. We ought to go there and learn what actually happened. So they, instead of doing the Hanford tank problems, I was discussing that with some people yesterday, they took this stuff and put it in the ground, in boreholes. And it's slowly drifting towards the Tom River out in Tomsk. So we said, we can go out, we can measure, we can learn something. You know, we don't ever want to do that experiment. But our government didn't want to go there. It was too hard to justify. Okay, so as we look now, particularly in terms of where Russia is today and the problems that we have, and as Metlock pointed that out, so a lot of people say, all right, so you paid $12 billion altogether for Nanluga. You guys, scientists, you played, you know, with the Russians. You did all these things. And now look, you know, what we have. We have Putin there on the other side. Was it worth it? And my answer is absolutely so. It's probably some of the best money we've ever spent. Loose nukes, tens of thousands were there. There were no loose nukes. Loose nuclear materials, 1.4 million kilograms. Guess what? Almost, you know, few, but not much. 1993, 94, there were reports of some of that stuff getting away in Prague and Munich. Not much. Just incredible. I would have never predicted this in 1992. Loose people, essentially nothing. Nothing. So this brain drain, not any worse than what we've had. You know, we've had a couple of people go off the reservation, so to speak. It wasn't there. Loose nuclear exports, a little problem in the 90s, but again, they become irresponsible, so no problems. That, regardless of where we are now, this could have turned the world in this totally different direction. You worry about nuclear terrorism, all of these things, you worry about nuclear proliferation. The fact that this did not happen, and now they're at a point where they're in much better control of all of these things. So they're in much better shape of making sure this nuclear stuff doesn't get out of the hands of governments. We're back now more to worrying about them being in the hands of governments, but they're at least not got out. So why? You know, the narrative on the American side is often, well, we paid for it. You know, we did it. Well, it turns out, sure, that helped. But the most important reason is the Russian nuclear workers and the Russian military, professional, patriotic, dedicated, responsible, and in Dostoevskian fashion, willing to suffer, willing to endure hardship. I mean, there were times I went over 1998, said, when was the last time you got paid? 6 months ago. 6 months. How do you live? Well, we get credit in the local grocery store. You know, they're hoping that someday we'll get paid again. They went through all of that, and they had the patriotism. They were not going to give away, you know, their country's ability to defend itself. And then this was one time when the U.S. government stood tall. It took cooperative measures. George H.W. Bush, nuclear initiative. Ambassador Matlock already told you how President Reagan and Gorbachev sort of set the stage for this. He was key. He turned down the heat instead of putting up the pressure. Nanluga, I mean, just, you know, visionary legislation. Clinton's PDD 47, worth a read. And then Charlie Curtis. So he was my hero because he gave us the money to really let this lab the lab go. And then we stepped in. You know, scientists stepped in, and I think we stepped in just in time. And we knew the importance of the human dimension. So remarkable cooperation. That's the narrative. And actually, what's so interesting, so in the last couple of years since Crimea, we actually found that in Russia, they don't want to admit this narrative anymore. Because the 1990s, you know, were the decade of embarrassment of Russia. And all those Americans, they helped them to embarrass Russia, bring Russia down. That's not what happened in the nuclear arena. Read the book. They're not embarrassed. They said, yeah, we didn't have any money. We had economic hardship. But they were there. They stood tall. And their nuclear complex survived. It wasn't decapitated. And so, if anything, the Russians ought to stand up today and say, by God, in the nuclear arena, we worked together. And it worked. And so that was one of the reasons why we wanted to finish the book. We were initially going to have three editors, my two colleagues from their weapon labs and myself. They pulled the plug on that in 2015 after we'd worked for almost 5 years. But they allowed me to keep the stories and the articles. And that's all I needed at that point. They were going to print, so I had to find a printer. And there were several people. And of course, people like Carnegie Corporation was helping to support me to do research and do activities like this. And I managed to get some help for the book from NTI and from a number of other places. So we managed to do the book, and the narrative is there from both sides. Okay, if you could set me up with the last module, and I'll go through bringing that to the present. Any questions before I go on to where we are today? Yes.
First of all, thank you for your speech. I had a quick question. So the whole narrative seems to be one of cooperation between both sides, but was there any pushback from either government? Were both governments incredibly cooperative, or was there some sort of pushback? And then secondly, as a side note, what language did you guys primarily speak in the lab to lab? Was it mostly Russian or was it English?
Sometimes German.
Oh, okay.
But one of the former director's wives, it turns out, and I overlapped in Vienna in 1953. I was a young kid there on a summer program, and she was there with her military father because they were occupying that section of Vienna. So she and I spoke German. The rest of the time, we spoke our own languages and we had interpreters. And it's actually, that would be a whole another interesting story and study of how crucial interpreters are. How you have to make sure that your interpreter, particularly like with Lydia Timofeeva, my friend, it was just so important I could get an interpreter that she's totally comfortable with. That's not easy when you come out of the Soviet system. And for all the time I've had, I only had one, what I consider to be very bad interpreter. And he was a guy who decided he's going to do his own thing. And he didn't just interpret. But so we spoke through interpreters. That was key. And the let's see, the first question was, so what about the governments, right? So it was sort of almost a love and hate relationship on both sides. Because I didn't say it specifically, but I had one line that says, essentially, and push the bureaucracy. Don't let the bureaucracy win. That's what I meant by that. You just had to keep pushing back because those people have different requirements. They got to answer to Congress. You still have congressmen, like the good Duncan Hunter, from Imperial Valley, you know, who was a very right-hand sort of guy. And I try to go there and tell him why we're going to spend this Russia. He says, they're our goddamn enemies. And so one has to worry about, government accountability office reviews of these programs. And it's the people in the government that have the job of then defending it. And we, at the laboratory, just, no, we got to go. We got to do this. So he had a constant problem. Sometimes I went to one of my visits to Sarov. I go through the embassy, not doing Ambassador Matlock's time, but one of his successors. And I'm going to Sarov, and they said, you got to take people from the embassy, from the State Department. And I said, but that's not going to work, because Russians consider all the people in the embassy as spies. And they're not going to let them in. And I've got a delegation of 8 people, including some industry people. I took Motorola industry people inside of Sarov. I took others in. They want to take State Department folks. That's not going to work. They said, you got to take them. So I said, okay. So we got 2 of them lined up. I'm ready to get on the 737 train. By the way, you have an overnight train to go 300 miles. It's just going every which way. We're ready to get on the train. About an hour before, I get a call from my colleague from Sarov, and it says, we've got this problem. The security service have decided only to let you in and nobody else from the delegation. I said, Vladimir, you know that I'm not going to accept that. He says, yes, I know. I told them that, but that's what they said. So those are the sort of things that were constantly there. But in the end, as I'll show you in a minute, all you need is a few heroes in Washington to sort of fight the rest of the bureaucracy. And on the Russian side, it was really interesting. In the 90s, we essentially had the security services on our side. We were working with their security services because they understood the dangers that were there. And then around 2000, as I will tell you when I get to this module, it all changed. And then on the Russian side, the security service started to take over and made it much, much more difficult to get in and essentially get back to where they viewed all of us as spies, not just the people from the embassy in Moscow. And that then slowed down the cooperation to where eventually it died. So, Ambassador Medlock, it's very close to the photo that you also found on the web. So how did we get from Boris Nikolaevich and Bill Clinton and their rapport to Obama and Putin? This was taken in 2013. So relationships changed. And what I was just telling you, it's important that the narrative is not changed, so that history isn't changed. That's why we wrote the book. So, you know, Putin says the U.S. is undermining global stability. And I often reference the Munich speech in 2007, where he really laid that out as to the problems they had. John McCain, you know, recently said, you know, he means to restore Russian power by weakening Western democracies. So, who's right? So what's happened in the nuclear arena, the stuff that I've worked, we could already tell by 2001 that they had decided they were going to try to keep us scientists and engineers out of their nuclear facilities. They just didn't think we needed to be there anymore. And then by 2014, 2015, they also wanted to make sure that we stayed away from their nuclear experts, not only their facilities. So they were on the road then over those last, 10 to 15 years, even though lots of good things were done, but at a much, much slower pace. And so that's why we wrote the book, to try to capture it from both sides. And then Crimea happened. And I was still there. I was there in April of 2014. I took this photo on the mural right outside of a place where we were visiting, with still meeting with my Russian colleagues, but not going to Zaporizhzhia, but meeting in Moscow. And they clearly, showed that as far as they're concerned, Crimea was there, and it was theirs. And as Ambassador Medlock said, you have to understand Russian history. And then, Putin has made a number of pronouncements, showing so his displeasure and his anger, where he's saying they're going to deploy new nuclear weapons, primarily. He uses the reason because of the U.S. missile shield. When we walked away from the ABM treaty, that was a major blow to the Russians. Ash Carter, who was Secretary of Defense by this time, talked about the nuclear saber rattling. And then the darndest thing is the Russian press leaked this. And that is a new weapon that they had developed, which, quite frankly, is the strangest thing. And it's an underwater, a torpedo drone that would take 6 days to come from wherever it's launched over near Russia. And it would come into New York Harbor, and it would detonate this huge explosion, set off a tsunami. And then the way they had built it, it would create cobalt-60, which would then spew radiation all over the rest of Manhattan and New York City. Why in the world would you want to do this? So people were alarmed at that. I said, this is silly. I mean, that's just, what are they going to do with this thing? But they want to show us, look, you guys build the anti-missile system, we'll get you underwater. We have a different way. And then in this book, a remarkable article by Rady Okayev, my counterpart at their Los Alamos, about nuclear weapons in Russia. And he lays out the strategy and he says, look, the strategic long-range weapons are for global deterrence. And we're going to work around those issues of ballistic missile defense. The tactical weapons, the short-range weapons, they're for regional deterrence and also to give us sort of the freedom of action that we think we need in our neighborhood. No apologies at the end of his article. He says, and this will all make the world safer. And they actually believe that. But then after Crimea and then a couple of the altercations, including President Obama calling them a regional power, they walked away from almost all of these things that I just mentioned. So actually terminating or suspending the whole, the NPCNA program, Nunluga, pulled out a nuclear security summit, suspended plutonium disposition, the science and technology agreement, terminated their reactor core conversion, and then apparently in the last couple of years violating this INF 1987 treaty. So any one of these would be regrettable, but put them all together sort of shows the end at this point of an era of cooperation, which is really unfortunate. Okay, so then we get into the modern time, and Ambassador Matlock has already given you the real previews of this. So when Donald Trump, back in December after he was elected, I said, hey, here are a couple of tweets that actually make very good sense. You know, so we must greatly, the second one. On the top one, it was a response to one of Putin's statements. Look, we're going to go ahead and strengthen our own nuclear capability. So this is the wrong one. These don't make sense. And let there be an arms race. You know, that's what it is. That's what he came back with. That was a response to one of the, what he thought were provocations. So that's the dark side. So what happened after Crimea? The brighter side is this working together. I showed you yesterday of the U.S. And Iran on the JCPOA, and particularly how the Americans and the Russians worked together. The Russians weren't just there not to be spoilers. They were actually there to help make this go. And so that's still, that was one of the few really good parts of cooperation. So how should we respond? You know, if Trump really says, let there be an arms race, and Putin is there developing these underwater torpedoes and so forth, to me is no return to the arms race. However, I feel very strong. We got to get our own house in order. And on having lived in the nuclear establishment off and on for 52 years, there are a lot of things we need to do. The complex is aging. The weapons are aging. We don't need to build more nuclear weapons. But we need to make sure we have people at our laboratories who are motivated, as I was, you know, when I got there and worked there. Those are the problems that we have. The Russians aren't our problem. We ourselves are our problem. We've made it so difficult to get work done in our nuclear complex. Everything nuclear in this country has become difficult. The country's finally building a few new reactors on the East Coast, and for a whole bunch of reasons, they've gone so far over budget that Westinghouse company was building has declared bankruptcy. And its parent organization, which is actually Toshiba, it might take Toshiba down. So we have things to do in our own complex. Need to get our house in order, but without nuclear testing. At this point, I don't want to get into it, but we lose more by going back to nuclear testing than we gain. And then, as was said here, we need to find areas of common interest. In the nuclear arena, it's strategic stability. No matter what we have, whether they have these underwater torpedoes, whether we have APM, stability, that's what we need to have. We got to have discussions on that. Don't want other countries to add to being nuclear powers. Nuclear terrorism, our most important things. And then the future of nuclear energy. So the book shows what's possible. Okay, so here are the quotes from Trump that I saw that I actually thought, look, this makes good sense. He said, we have enough problems around the world without yet another one. When I'm president, Russia will respect us far more than they do now. And a good relationship with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing. Only stupid people. Well, he didn't have to add that. But if he would have just stopped that it's not a bad thing, it's absolutely right. So I thought, look, we actually had something going for us with Russia. And what I found on the Russian side, all of a sudden things started to loosen up. My colleagues had not been allowed to meet with me for 2 years after that April 14th. And so when I was over there earlier this year, they were allowed to meet with me in Moscow. We met. And they also told me they're going to take the book and publish it as is in Russian. So they're going to go ahead and publish in Russian so that the Russians can actually read the stories themselves. So that's what I had. So I thought, you know, things are loosening up and maybe getting better. So we captured that. Here is the Russians didn't see the end of this book because they pulled out. So I have about 15 articles in here, and they haven't seen any of those. And so they were quite worried about what the book would say, whether there would be Russia bashing. But I told it the way I felt about the book. And then we send them the copy. Here's their response. The book, quite frankly, was a shock. It is so good. It looks great. The content is positive. I have to be honest, I like it very much. That's the head of one of their international sections in one of the labs. The overview is fantastic. I wrote that overview, so I particularly, you know, like that part of it. And then one of the other lab directors, former lab directors, said, it takes us back to those glorious days of our cooperation. So that's what I was hoping for. I should have had a preview. So my hope was that Trump and Putin would at least work things out, and I thought we're going to ride off into the future together. That's what I was expecting, and I thought, you know, who knows, with all the other things going on, there may be some good to come out of this. But then, as Ambassador Matlock told you yesterday, for heaven's sakes, you know, how bad things went, you know, from the Comey fire to the intrigue and what happened with poor guy, Sergei Kislyak, who actually is a MIFI graduate, it turns out, and of course, in Lavrov, in Trump's office, to Michael Flynn, to Paul Manafort, you know, who had to quit his campaign. And so we have this Russia intrigue. So once again, whatever was there, and I think Ambassador Matlock captured that yesterday, we're doing things to ourselves that are much worse than anybody else can do to us. And, you know, how you get out of this, again, I'm just a scientist. I'm going to leave it to Ambassador Matlock. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be happy to entertain questions at this point.